Good morning. Well, we've had one hell of a political year with so many controversies, and I'd say there were sighs of relief all around when the Dáil and Seanad adjourned for their summer break. Cork North West TD Áine Collins was at the centre of the Lapgate affair when her party colleague, Deputy Tom Barry, dragged her onto his lap during a marathon late night sitting on the abortion bill. The embarrassing incident was caught on camera and went viral around the world, opening up a debate on the apparent sexist and laddish culture inside the Dáil and Seanad. She broke her silence on the matter when she spoke with Áine Lawler last Sunday.
Áine Collins, you must be one of the most talked about, googled, tweeted, watched politicians in the Dáil this past life.
It has been definitely challenging, and it has been an experience of its own, you know, going from hardly being known to almost being very well known.
And you're not just known in Ireland. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands, maybe 500,000 hits. You know, The Huffington Post, the BBC, The Guardian. There's that video of you in your pink suit walking across the Dáil chamber, being grabbed, pushing yourself up and walking away. At the time, what did it feel like?
It's very hard to describe it. I mean, here we were debating some of the most difficult legislation in 30 years to go through the Dáil. We were all very concerned about some of our colleagues, who what they were going to vote, and it was kind of unfolding before our eyes. And the other side of it is that, you know, because so many people wanted to speak on a particular issue, it kept being extended and extended. So it was kind of one of those nights where you're kind of hanging around, you're looking at, you're watching television.
It's 3 in the morning.
23 in the morning, yeah. And we were watching television because it was on live.
And you hadn't been drinking in the Dáil bar?
No,
I think Tom Barry admitted he had some drinks, yeah.
I'd spent most of the evening with my good colleague Nicky McFadden, who'd been up to vote. And I had walked her out to the car at about 12 or half 12 or something like that. And I'd been in my office and I'd come down to the bar. I'd had a cup of tea, I'd had a Twix bar. We were kind of in and out and people were doing a lot of moving, you know.
And you're walking past Tom Barry, and do you say something to him, or did he say something to you? How did it all happen?
It just happened very quickly. And, you know, it was very disrespectful. It was very inappropriate, especially where we were, to me personally, but also in the context of the fact that we were in the House of Parliament.
And it's like you had to push yourself out of his arms. Did you say to him, let me go, and he wouldn't? Or
no, there was nothing like that. To be honest, it happened very quickly. You know, everybody saw it on video. I mean, I tried to get up as quickly as I possibly could and just walked on.
Even the way you walk away, you looked disgusted.
Yes, that says it all. But, you know, Deputy Barry apologised to me. After it happened, he apologised nationally the following day. I mean, it was just all very sudden, as I said. And as far as I'm concerned, there's a line drawn under the sand and we all have to move on.
Was it more offensive what happened, or to hear a party spokesman describe it as horseplay?
I suppose they were equally both.
Because you weren't engaged in any horseplay.
No, I wasn't. And that was withdrawn, as you know, very shortly after it had been issued. And Tom Curran, our General Secretary, had come out and apologised on behalf of the party and had made a statement early afternoon that day, you know. The horseplay word was very unfortunate, and I would certainly have preferred if that hadn't been the word that was used, because it's very obvious from the video that it wasn't horseplay.
Yeah. Cork North West TD Áine Collins. So what's the culture really like in the heady corridors of political power? Three women who have ringside seats discussed their working lives with Áine Lawler. Catherine Halloran is political correspondent with the Irish Star, Niamh Lyons, Polcor with the Irish Daily Mail, and political sketch writer with the Irish Independent, Lise Hand.
Is it a boys' club?
Yes, I think it probably is a boys' club to a certain extent. I mean, obviously the numbers are stacked against women in there. The predominant number of members of the Oireachtas are male. And it is a clubby atmosphere, there's no doubt about it. Work is done, a lot of it is done through the network, and the boys all, you know, doing favours for each other and so on. The atmosphere is quite laddish. But, I mean, having said that, I also have worked for many years in a newsroom, and the atmosphere is also equally laddish. So this isn't something that's unique to the corridors of power, perhaps, you could argue. I think if you're a woman who maybe just as a first-time TD or a first-time senator, I think it might be a very intimidating place.
Gender balance among politicians is always a topic of hot debate. Male political correspondents also outnumber their colleagues in the press gallery.
And funnily enough, even though we're looking down as a press gallery on the Dáil chamber and noticing there are men massively outnumbering women, in the press gallery itself, there's around 100 of us, and it's 60-40 men to women. And we collectively refer to ourselves as the Monoctus, the women of the Oireachtas.
<Yes. laughs>
And what we do every year is that we go out for a dinner together, and
no men allowed.
It does two things. It kind of brings us together and we can relate on that level of, you know, has anyone seen the bottom of their laundry basket this year? No, me neither. And it also infuriates the Fur Octus because they can't organise the booze up in the proverbial brewery. You know, even though journalists, you know, there's a collegiality between us and we'd cut one another's throats for a story, let's be honest about it. But you do have to stick together in that environment. Mm-hmm.
But you say it's a microcosm of society. I mean, you're stuck with the same, you know, weird hours and kind of living in this kind of little bubble that all the politicians have to live in. So there's kind of the personal cost of all of that on the one hand. Yes. And then on the other hand, people don't shout and roar at each other the way they get to do in the Dáil. People don't have bars in their workplace where you can sit around all night. In some ways, it's a really artificial and almost kind of out of date place, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, there is an artificiality, and it's quite about Leinster House, and it is often called literally the bubble. And yes, it can be quite a pressure cooker environment when there could be a big political story happening. And the hours, they are definitely unsociable because they're unpredictable.
And you're sort of thinking to yourself, there probably is another life. There is another timetable one could be on. Some people get to book a cinema ticket and know they'll get to go. But there is nothing like the excitement and being the one to work on the story and knowing that what you witness, that we're there to bear witness, and what you witness is what people will read the next day.
So you do all have that kind of, you know, political junkie quality about you.
I think you'd never survive.
Meanwhile, in the Shannon, the bill on the protection of life during pregnancy was passed on Tuesday by 39 votes to 14. That bill has now gone to the President, who's called a meeting of the Council of State next Monday afternoon. And the referendum on the abolition of the Shannon is scheduled for the 4th of October, as RTE's political correspondent David Evan-Power told Gavin Jennings.
They're not going to have an awful lot of time to defend the Shannon either. It's only going to be a 2 or 3 week campaign when the Shannon and the Dáil resumes in September. Will they have much opportunity between now and then to make their case?
Well, the abolition of the Shannon is an issue that animates the political classes in a big way. It's probably a bigger issue among those with an interest in politics than it is in the country in general. So we can expect it to be a big topic of conversation at the various summer schools. I suppose the campaign itself, there will be a bit of a phony war before the campaign itself gets underway, because the Dáil is back, as you say, on September the 18th. The poll is just over 2 weeks after that. So in the nature of things, I suspect the campaign itself won't really get underway until the politicians get back to Leinster House. It will be a short campaign. The government will obviously be throwing their weight behind it, particularly Fine Gael, because there's a lot riding on it for Enda Kenny, since it's basically his idea. Defeat would be worse than embarrassing for Mr. Kenny. The government, I think, also want to get the whole business out of the way well before what's likely to be a painful budget later in the month.
David Davin-Power on the future of the Shannon. Well, Fianna Fáil Senator Éireann Power had more personal matters on her mind yesterday when she came into Miriam O'Callaghan's studio. She only discovered she was adopted at the age of 9 when a neighbour's child teased her younger sister about being adopted. In 2007, she decided to find her biological mother, and they met in August that year.
Well, we met through Barnardo's. When I got the letter from the adoption board, they said that then they were referring me to Barnardo's. Barnardo's run a mediation service for people who want to meet, a post-adoption service. So before I met her at all, I went into Barnardo's and I sat down with a counsellor and talked it through with her, because it is a really emotional and quite frightening experience as well to kind of finally meet your mum when you're in your mid-20s. And then they did the same with her, and we exchanged letters and things like that over a few months. And then eventually, then one day, I think it was the 27th of August 2007, we both went into the Barnardo's office, and I went in first, and Christine, who's the counsellor there, said, you know, okay, in a few minutes I'm going to bring in your mum. And then she went out and she got my mum and she came back in with her.
That's so. Is she like you?
Yeah, she looks an awful lot like me. She really does. And it was just the, I suppose when she first walked into the room, I think we both just looked at each other and thought, God, you know, and couldn't say anything for a few minutes. I think the two of us just kind of cried and hugged, and just sat there for a minute taking it all in.
So far, so good. But Avril was anxious about telling her parents that she'd contacted her birth mother.
I got myself in an awful knot about telling my parents. I think it took me about, after I decided I was going to tell them, it took me about 2 weeks. And I couldn't sleep and I was just in a total knot about it. But then when I told them, they were great.
How did you tell them? Like, did you call them up? Or
I called them up and I said, look, are you free for lunch? Come around to the house and we'll have something to eat on Saturday or Sunday. Then they came around and they came in and I said, look, sit down.
They probably didn't know what you were going to say.
No, they didn't. And then like when I said to them, I said, look, I found my mum. And then my dad just like straight away went, thank God. Like, you know, you're not sick.
Oh, that's so nice. Such a nice reaction.
I think they had a sense, you know what I mean? That there was something up and that I had something to tell them. And I think they were worried. And then my dad just went, right, grand, so whatever.
No big deal.
And then he like took out the paper and that was grand. Like that's typical great. Irish dad style. He was like, sure, that's grand. You know what I mean? We'd be happy with you doing that.
While it was an emotional process for all concerned, it was ultimately very rewarding.
Has meeting your natural mum, your birth mum, made you look at yourself different? Do you understand yourself much better now that you've met her?
Yeah, you find it. I think you kind of just feel grounded or have a sense of kind of peace for all those questions that I didn't have, that I didn't know about myself, that I now understand that. And I get maybe where parts of my personality and things like that come from. When my mum first sent me a letter to Bernardo's back before we'd met, in the first letter that she sent me, I just couldn't get over the similarities, like first from like the photos of what she looks like, but then from the fact that like after my brother's brother and sisters had grown up, she'd gone back to college and studied social policy.
Wow.
So she's like really similar interests to me and things like that. And, you know, there's always that debate about nature and nurture and what you get from your biological parents and which kind of characteristics you get from the environment that you grow up in. We've an awful lot in common. I think we're quite similar personality wise and things like that. And I think I just... you have a greater sense of completeness as a person just for knowing how you fit into things and where you've come from.
Senator Avril Power heard on the John Murray Show with Miriam yesterday. Well, across the pond in London, there was great joy on Monday with the birth of a son to Kate and Wills. And there was wall-to-wall media coverage around the world with no detail too trivial to exaggerate about the little prince. So just for the record, he was born at 24 minutes past four on Monday afternoon. He weighed in at 8 pounds, 6 ounces. His name is George Alexander Louis and he's third in line to the throne. Reporter Colm Flynn tested the temperature on the streets of Dublin.
I don't agree with the monarchy in principle, but I think you'd want to be fairly hard-hearted, not to be sort of bowled over by William and Kate. I think they seem really down to earth. I think everybody's really excited and there's so much doom and gloom in the news that to hear a positive story like that is lovely. So I have to say, I think everybody was secretly delighted whether they'd admit it or not.
But all this big hype and it's on Sky News and BBC News and in all the papers.
It's a British thing, isn't it? And because we're our nearest and dearest neighbours, we get roped in on it. There is a lot of royalists still over here. They're just underground and every so often they come out.
I mean, nice for them, but I don't know them. So, has no effect on me.
It's not news, is it? It's a woman giving birth. I think there's a headline in the Metro today that says famous woman gives birth and that's as far as it goes.
I think if Princess Diana was alive now, she'd be very proud.
A baby into the world is beautiful. I'm a grandmother and my daughter's expecting her second baby. It's wonderful. Bit of joy.
And were you watching it on TV when they were waiting for the baby to
be born? Yeah, watching the whole lot. What people think, it's only a baby. Everyone has babies, you know what I mean? What's the big deal about this one? You know, is it the fourth baby in the world?
But does it not excite you, the future king?
He's not my king. He's not my king. I don't know him. I don't know him, man. There's no time to tell you, that's it.
I think it's lovely. I think it's lovely to have some happiness around us with all the doom and gloom. Congratulations to them both.
Colm Flynn reporting. Well, Gloria Honeyford, herself a doting granny, spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday.
When you think about it, it's 2013, Gloria. Does it seem odd that there can be one family with such privilege, especially maybe at a time of deep recession and even depression in some countries?
There's no question that the royal family is different to any other royal family, in my opinion, throughout the world. And they bring so much tourism, so much interest. And really, you only have to look at the tourists who queued up at Buckingham Palace last night just to have a glimpse at a piece of paper because they wanted to feel part of history. I'm thrilled about the baby. Would I have gone and queued at Buckingham Palace Gate to have a look at the paper? No, I wouldn't, but an awful lot of people did and were able to join in the sheer delight of it all. I mean, William has been through so much and he will be missing his mum not being here to have a look at this gorgeous baby.
Well, the spin-off from the little prince's birth is already yielding dividends. Fashionistas tell us that infant wear will be big this season and George himself will want for nothing. He'll even have his own tea towel, as Gavin Jennings found out when he spoke with Heather Harvey of Ulster Weavers.
It sounds like quite an honour. How did you get this contract or this royal warrant?
Basically, we'd been providing kitchen textiles to Buckingham Palace for years. So once you've been doing it for over 5 years and they still continue on, they give you the royal warrant. So we've held it since about 1995 now.
Now, these will go on general sale as well, won't they?
Yeah, we do a whole range of designs for Buckingham Palace itself, and then obviously designs for their tourist shop. They're available for everyone, the royal family.
And do you sell them in the north, Heather? Because I'd imagine, judging from the crowds that we're seeing outside Buckingham Palace, there would be quite a degree of interest in any royal bric-a-brac, for want of a better word now.
Yes, well, I'd say all our retail customers here would be interested in them as well.
Over on 2FM, Hector O'Huckagon was on the lookout for our own royal Celtic baby. He spoke with Donna Burns from Tipperary.
Apparently I had a baby at the same time as Earl, wasn't you?
Are you the mummy?
I am, yes.
Tell me more. Congratulations.
Thank you. He's great.
A little boy?
Yep.
Born yesterday afternoon?
Yep.
Where?
In Clonmel Hospital in Tipperary.
At what time exactly?
16:24.
Oh, I could be talking to the chosen one. Never mind the little Buddha. You could be the mummy of the Celtic child. The royal Celtic child. Tell me about your baby.
He's great. He's just getting checked over here by the doctor. So yes, he's not too happy.
Oh, little, does he bit of wind?
Yeah.
What weight was he, Donna?
He was 6 pounds 2.
Is he a first son in the family or?
Second
boy. Across the water, they're celebrating the royal child. We are celebrating the Celtic child. Have you a name, any ideas? Give us the names.
Name's Owen William O'Donnell.
Owen William O'Donnell, that is it. That's magnificent. How's mummy doing?
I'm doing absolutely fabulous. Looking forward to getting home.
And were you long in there? When did you go in? Was it quick in?
I came in yesterday at 1:30.
And baby born, and 3 hours later. You deserve a medal. Congratulations, Donna. We will never forget the birth. We will never forget the name. All hail the royal Celtic child.
From Breakfast with Hector on 2FM. Well, there was excitement too on the literary scene here when it emerged that 3 Irish writers had been included in the long list of 13 for this year's prestigious Man Booker Prize. Colm McCann for Transatlantic, Colm Tobin, long-listed for the third time, and newcomer Donal Ryan for his debut novel, The Spinning Heart. And I was reading John Spain's book column in The Independent, and apparently the novel was plucked out of a slush pile by an intern working for the Lilliput Press, who raved about it to publisher Anthony Farrell. So lucky, lucky for Donal Ryan. He spoke with Rachel English on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
You had to submit the book to quite a few publishers before you finally found one. How many do you reckon?
Oh, well, it was, I suppose, approaching 50 between publishers and agents. The level of rejection really was my own fault because I went against all the received wisdom and advice that's given to aspiring novelists, and I sent my manuscripts out everywhere. I was firing off 4 or 5 emails at a time and printing off 5 manuscripts and sending them out really willy-nilly all over the place.
All of that, though, it must make it all the sweeter that you're now in this position that you're long-listed for the Man Booker and that you have a second novel coming out before too long.
Yeah, it's actually the first novel I finished. It's called The Thing About December and it's out in September. It's just unbelievable. I mean, for 2 or 3 hours yesterday, I was literally speechless.
You do also have a day job.
Yeah.
You don't write full-time.
No.
How do you manage the two?
Well, for the 2 novels, I was really strict and I was really disciplined with myself, and I wrote from 9 p.m. to midnight pretty much every night, and I got really absorbed. For about a year and a half or 2 years, I really was.
And what do your colleagues, you're a civil servant, I think, what do they make of this? The guy at the next desk or in the next office has just been nominated for the Booker Prize.
Well, there are about 14 of us in the office, and the lads are actually all readers, pretty much. They all really like the book as well, so it's just great. It's a bit of crack in the office, you know. It's a great thing for the lads as well, really.
Mm-hmm. And would they have known all the way along that you were going home at night and writing?
Yeah, I kind of dropped hints here and there. Oh, you know, I'm writing a book. And, you know, then when I kind of started to get a bit of interest, I kind of, you know, told the full story. But they've been really supportive. It's been great.
Do you plan to continue working, or would you hope to be able to write full time at some stage?
Well, it would be great to be able to write full time, even for 6 months or a year. So hopefully, you know, the Booker long list might boost sales, so that might happen.
And Donal Redd from The Spinning Heart on Arena.
Having a wife is great. You can say things to your wife that you never knew you thought. It just comes out of you when the person you're talking to is like a part of yourself. We went to a play inside in town one time. I can't remember the name of it. You couldn't do that without a wife. Imagine being found out that you went to see a play on your own. With a woman, you have an excuse for every kind of soft thing. The play was about a man and wife. They just sat on the stage on either side of a table, facing the audience, talking about each other. Your man was like my father, only not as bad. The wife was lovely. She was dog-tired of your man's all selfish ways, but she persevered with him all the same. He sat there, drinking a glass of whiskey that was really red lemonade and smoking fag after fag, grinning back to his 2 ears as she read him to the audience. He had no smart reply for everything she said about him. They aged on stage as they were talking. I don't know how it was done. For a finish, they were both old and their lives were near spent. And at the very last, your man turned around and admitted he thought the world of her. He'd always loved her. He put his hand on her cheek and looked at her and cried. Christ, you remember some actor. On the way home in the car, tears spilled down my face. Trina just said, "All love, all love."
Donal Ryan, and we'll have to wait until September to see if he makes the shortlist. Well, they say that behind every great man, there's a great woman. Lily Capel has just written a book about the wives behind the American astronauts.
Pressure was on from NASA to be a model wife in everything they said and did. And without much training, they were expected to hold up this whole human public relations angle of the program. And one of the first credos within NASA was, if you don't have a perfect marriage, your husband isn't going to have a space flight. And things like Gordo and Trudy Cooper, Gordo being one of the Mercury 7 astronauts, and Trudy, they were separated before he got into the program. And he knew there was no way he was going to be picked as an astronaut if he didn't have that perfect little seemingly looking Stepford wife back at home. So he promptly got back together with Trudy for the sake of the space race. And she was quite adventurous. She was an aviatrix herself. One of the other wives was previously divorced, Marge Sladen. So the women felt acutely the pressure to live up to those really impossible standards that the public and NASA was imposing on them.
But not all wives fitted the NASA-approved model.
This is their first shoot for Life magazine, and they're all told to wear these perfect pastel shirtwaist dresses, sort of the perfect outfit for the ideal 1950s housewife, which, of course, NASA is going to demand this very squeaky clean image from all of the astronauts' spouses. And they all decide to play ball, except for Rene Carpenter, who was dishy and blonde and vivacious and opinionated. JFK would later say he found her the most attractive of the astronaut wives. And she said there was no way she was going to let the government tell her what to wear. And so she shows up in this sort of cocktail number, splashed with these big magenta roses, is wearing red high heels, and wow, makes quite an impression on the photographer, the other wives, and of course, makes the shot.
But being an astronaut's wife was not all glamour and cocktail parties. There was considerable strain being married to a man on the moon.
After Apollo 11, the world just blew up with these guys, and Nixon sends the Apollo 11 couples on this fabulous round-the-world tour where they're presenting moon rocks to everyone from Queen Elizabeth to, you know, every head of state, dictators of the time. It was really incredible. But Buzz really started having a hard time on this tour. And Joan actually shared with me her diary that she kept while they went to over 30 countries in just over a month. One of the things she realizes is Buzz having a very hard time being sort of in Neil's shadow and dealing with being second on the moon. At one point, they were having a nightcap, and Joan said to Buzz, you know, I think within time, things will return to normal, sort of this expectation for the astronauts and their wives to be involved in this global pony show and public relations effort, that will go away and we'll get to just be a normal family again. You'll get to be the father that you haven't been able to be to our children because you've been training so hard like all the other astronauts. And he just looked at her and he said, Joan, I've been to the moon. Nothing's ever going to be the same.
Lily Coppell, whose book is called Astronaut Wives.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
On Wednesday, there was a dramatic rescue off the coast of Cork when a Dutch sail training ship, the Astrid, hit the rocks just outside Kinsale Harbour. All 30 crew on board, including teenage trainees, were brought to safety thanks to the professionalism of the rescue services. Vincent O'Donovan, press officer with Cort McSharry Lifeboat, spoke with Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
We got a mayday call from Valencia Coast Guard just at 12 o'clock. The lifeboat in Cork McSherry assembled immediately. We had 7 crew on board the boat within 4 or 5 minutes. And our all-weather lifeboat, Cork McSherry, was tasked along with Kinsale, our Lally boat as well. And we were underway and at the scene at about 12:35.
What did the crew find when they got there?
When they got there, they were expecting a very serious situation because it was well flagged as we went out. They got there, the tall ship had hit the rocks. It was breaking up and sinking, and the crew on board the sail training vessel had abandoned ship to the life rafts.
How serious a situation did you have on your hands at that stage?
It was a very, very serious situation, and I suppose, thank God, everybody was saved. The wind today was blowing strong, southeasterly, kind of 5 to 6. And there's a steep rocks and a heavy swell in that area, and the boat lost power, then was blown onto the rocks, and it's happened very, very quickly. And it was a fast response all around by the vessels in the area, the lifeboats that were able to save all 30 people and bring them ashore. Within the hour and 15 minutes, they were all on the pier in Kinsale. There was 23 teenagers, 7 of a crew. They had suffered a severe shock for the previous 40 minutes, and they were suffering from mild hypothermia, but the major accident plan of Cork was activated as well, and you had the medical teams from the Cork University Hospital on the pier with 5 ambulances in Kinsale. You had the Coast Guard helicopters from Shannon and Waterford, and the Coast Guard ground units from Oysterhaven. So it was a very, very fast response all around that helped save everybody today.
Unfortunately, the outcome was very different in Spain when a train derailed outside the pilgrim town of Santiago de Compostela with the loss of many lives. Galicia is now in mourning for 7 days. RTE's Europe correspondent Paul Cunningham described the situation there to Rachel English on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
It was around 247 passengers and workers on the train at the time, but some people were able to simply walk away from the wreckage, and they have been talking just about the speed with which the accident happened. The train was travelling, and once it came out of the tunnel and went around the bend, people were aware something was happening, that the train was travelling at a greater speed than one would have expected, and then it derailed. And these 8 carriages rolled over several times. One was thrown high into the air, and at that stage, people were just hanging on and hoping that they weren't going to be hurt. Many escaped by travelling through, by crawling through windows under the carriage itself, and they were just delighted to be alive. Because when it comes down to identifying the dead, that's a complicated process. While the names have been released of many of those who died, 13 are yet unidentified. In some cases, that's because relatives haven't been able to make it to the city. Unfortunately, on the other hand, some of the injuries have been so bad that it's going to require DNA evidence for them to be identified. So that process is ongoing at a makeshift morgue on the edge of the city.
Paul Cunningham reporting from Santiago for Morning Ireland yesterday. Well, you'd make yourself dizzy trying to keep up with the twists and turns and the drama of the GAA Championships. Last Sunday in Clonus, Monaghan trounced the All-Ireland champions Donegal 13-7, giving Monaghan their first Ulster Football Championship win in 25 years. And this is the moment that sealed their famous 6-point victory.
The photographers are gathering around Malachy O'Rourke and the Monaghan selectors. Neil McAdam releases Monaghan and Tommy Freeman. He's hardly on the pitch a minute, but the ball has gone over the bar. He's punching his fist and Monaghan are now gone up to 13 points and they're on the verge of a sensational upset.
On Take Your Point, just after the game, Damien O'Reilly talked tactics with Monaghan's most famous veteran player, Nudie Hughes.
Monaghan, they got it right today. They played Donegal at their own game, but Donegal, did the wrong Donegal turn up today? How poor were Donegal today?
Donegal looked very jet-lagged. I was in Ardra last week with Pat Cassidy from Carrick Macross, and what I learned is that they were training flat out up on Sunday morning. Literally flat out in preparation for an Ulster final that was taking place today. And they looked a very jaded team. Frankie McGlynn was the only player that looked a bit of jizz in him. Ryan McHugh that came on, he looked well.
And as expected, Mayo beat London in the Connacht final in McHale Park in Castlebar. London team supporter comedian Dara O'Brien was sanguine.
Good morning, Dara O'Brien. Conas sa thothu. Being in London, though, seriously, Dara, does it make a difference when you have something like that London football team?
If you're in the UK, none of this works. We're not sitting there, you know, sending our kids to Irish dancing classes and attending the local J Club. Anywhere near the same amount if you're in Chicago or if you're in Melbourne or something. You just don't do it that way. We're so fitta-futa. We're so woven into the population here that it's very normal for us not to clan together, to be honest. There's no Irish ghetto in London anymore. Kilburn is essentially Greek and Turkish at the moment. And those kind of, you know, the ballrooms have all shut. So it was an interesting small focal point among a community who don't really feel the need to do it. Because we're so desperately close to home. So, for example, the gathering made no impact on people over here. I don't think there was. I mean, if we're over, we're over, you know, because it's an hour away.
Yeah.
So it's so it wasn't any kind of element of this is the time for us to make the long journey back home. So it has been unusual to see some sort of focal point. But just well done to the lads.
And you can be sure there'll be more excitement and upset in sport this weekend with full coverage here on RT Radio 1. Well, how we're viewed in Germany naturally came up in conversation when Pat Kenny spoke with Dan Mulhall, Ireland's ambassador to Germany. He's a lifelong fan of W.B. Yeats and he's taking part in a new festival called Tread Softly, which runs in County Sligo for the next 2 weeks.
What I'm doing here, talking about Yeats, is connected actually with my day job because I rekindled an interest in Yeats from taking an exhibition round Germany to various universities, an exhibition on Yeats, which was done by the Department of Foreign Affairs a couple of years ago. And I discovered this enormous interest in Irish literature among students and academics. And many of these people had become fans of Ireland because they had read Joyce, they had read Yeats. So I discovered that our literature is part of our national brand and it makes us interesting in the eyes of others in ways that we wouldn't be had we not possessed this great literary tradition
so
that people respond to.
Other noise like the Anglo tapes and so on, it makes a dent in our overall image, I suppose, but not much more than that?
No, Germans have an extremely positive view of Ireland. It comes from the works of Heinrich Böll, the famous German Nobel Prize laureate who came to Ireland in the 50s, and most Germans have read his Irish Journal, which talks about the friendly, beautiful country that he visited. And therefore, there's a positive attitude towards Ireland. Many people are fans of Irish music. In fact, I would say that outside of Ireland and perhaps Britain, the next biggest fan base for Irish traditional music is probably in Germany. For example, recently, I was down in Saarbrücken at a festival. I came across these musicians singing and playing music and singing in the Irish language. And I talked to them afterwards. They were all Germans. None of them had ever been to Ireland, but they had a fascination with Irish culture. And these people are likely to be lifelong fans of Ireland. Mm. And that's a very important thing because a small country always risks being overlooked and ignored. But because of our literature and because of our history and because of our music and our culture, we have a profile in the world that's positive and I think should be regarded as something of an asset to us in these days.
So what happens in your job when something like the Anglo tapes break? Because it became a Europe-wide story, if not a global story. What do you have to do?
A very important part of the job of all Irish ambassadors these days is economic messaging. And we've been doing this now very actively for many years, but certainly since the beginning of the crisis, we've been out there. My aim is to get behind the headlines and to try and communicate something of the realities of Ireland. I don't try to pretend that everything in our economy is rosy, but I try to put forward positive images of Ireland and put across positive messaging.
And you can hear Dan Mulhall's talk on Yeats next Monday as part of the Tread Softly Festival in Sligo. The Irish designer and architect David Collins had an international reputation and counted many famous clients among his close friends. He died from skin cancer after a very short illness, and Madonna flew into Dublin on Tuesday for his funeral mass and to pay tribute to him. Orna Mulcahy, editor of the Irish Times magazine, was another close friend of his, and she spoke with Miriam.
So he was great fun. You could have a real honest chat with him, and I think that was why he was so popular with all those well-known people. Sure, aren't they only ordinary people at the end of the day? They all like to talk about the same thing, and that's the kind of thing he liked to talk about. Friendship, being warm, being there for them, because when he was there for you, he was literally on the phone all the time. He was a great listener. His advice was fabulous.
Well, I know, speaking to a family member earlier this morning, that they were very, very touched that Madonna flew in. I know there was a lunch afterwards in the Ritz-Carlton,
yes,
and she paid a beautiful tribute to him. But he would have been delighted, wouldn't he? Because he bought a portrait.
Yeah.
Tell me about how close he was to Madonna.
We were at this art show, and there was a portrait of her by Mario Testino, the photographer, who was at the time only becoming well known also. I remember David saying, "I love that portrait." And I said, "But look at the price of it. Sure, $3,000 or something like that." And he said, "Oh, well," he said, "it's absolutely beautiful." And the next thing, he had bought it, and he didn't have very much money at the time. And I remember thinking, "God, that's absolutely mad money." And he had that in his room in his house. And that would have been, gosh, in the late 80s. Quite a few years later, he met her. He was designing a nightclub for a friend of hers in Miami. They got talking, and literally the minute you started to talk to David and you realised what he was like, that was it. He'd be friends instantly. I think she came to London not so long afterwards to buy her house, etc. And she didn't know anybody, she said. And she gave him a call and said, "You seem to be somebody who knows things." And after that, they were inseparable. And she talked quite a lot about that in her speech about him, which she actually had asked very nicely to the family, could she talk? She didn't assume she could. She said, "Would you mind if I spoke about David?" And she talked about going around London in his little sports car and looking up at the stars and him, you know, telling her, "Now, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other," which is what he did with people. And after that, I think they were just firm friends.
Orna Mulcahy of the Irish Times remembering her friend, the designer David Collins. Well, another person with an interest in design and collecting is 12-year-old John Joe Brennan, who was born with cerebral palsy. We first got to know John Joe when he lit up our screens on The Late Late Show, and he told Ryan that he wanted to be a neurologist. Well, 4 years on, his fascination with clocks continues.
What is it about old things, like even those clocks, that fascinates you?
Well, I think it's just the way they're made and the way they're functional, their combination of science, technology, their art, their decor, and they're functional. I mean, that's a lot of pointers, but I mean, it's a combination of all those things, even how each gear latches into another gear and just how they work. It's ingenious, really, and yes, so that sort of triggers my interest. And as for old things, because I do collect other things aside from clocks, even though they're the main collection, I think that it's just collecting things from another time that I wasn't there to see. And that, you know, it's a whole learning process, if you like. So.
John Joe Brennan with Miriam O'Callaghan.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
On the documentary On One last Saturday, Joe Duffy visited a big house steeped in political history. Number 3 Mountjoy Square in Dublin's north inner city was once a safe house for Sinn Féin leaders in the 1920s, a hiding place for the likes of De Valera, Michael Collins and Arthur Griffiths, and a place where the first Thall used to meet in secret. Well, the building is now used as a centre for adult education, and Joe stumbled upon its historic past when he went to present prizes to students there.
To the basement here of the Adult Learning Centre, this is where the canteen is, and this is where students come when they want to experience what's known as taster classes, because the whole idea here is of welcoming people into the learning centre and encouraging them to actually participate in education once again.
I found out I was actually coming for the first day
But I remember going to Mass, 8 o'clock Mass that morning, because I was dreading meeting the lady that was to teach me. I was praying that she'd be all right, that she wasn't going to be an archy woman, you know what I mean? And it turns out she was a very nice person and that I would learn to read and write. And the first two books I read so far, the first one being John F. Kennedy and the other is President Mandela. They're the opposite. One had the wealth and the other struggled for it. But it was a great, two great stories.
Were they the first two books you ever read?
They were the first two books I ever read. I never read comics or anything like that growing up as a child. So they were the first two books.
And you learned to read here, number three. But what, can I ask, what age are you, Michael?
I'm 61.
So you were 61 when you read your first book?
61 when I read my first book.
One of the other guests in the house that day was Pauline Cole O'Kennedy, whose family home it was.
Well, there was just lovely furniture and lovely, lovely silver and the thing I still love, porcelain, and we lovely china and all that kind of thing. And it was all part of that sort of scene. But a thing I always remember about Mountjoy Square, there was chandeliers somewhere, and I used to have great fun. They had to take these little glass things separately, and we had great fun looking through them because it made the stairs. That's another thing I have to tell you about beautiful Georgian stairs. They made the stairs like one, however way you look through the glass, and I can remember enjoying doing that. I'll show you, I have these little photographs here. That'll tell you how old I am. That was our nurse. And look at the outfit.
Yeah, straight out of Downton Abbey, isn't
it? Absolutely, yes. Now, there's Papa, see? And then me, look at me. He thought the sun, moon and stars shone out of me. That's what I was always told.
Well, Pauline's father, Walter Cole, was himself a committed Republican.
Were there stories of the fact that Michael Collins, Arthur Griffith stayed there quite
a
lot?
Of Michael Collins, because he was very handsome, apparently, and the ladies used to talk about him. And I think I met Kitty Kiernan at one stage, and I can remember a lot of talk about all that time.
Is that where he stayed in your house?
He must have stayed in Arthur Griffith's room, because that would have been the room where they was marked out for those sort of people to stay in, maybe. I honestly don't know.
And where did Kitty Kiernan stay, Paul?
That's another question. I don't know. But she apparently didn't accept him for a while.
Was he a bit of a rogue, I wonder?
I suppose he was. Sure. All men are rogues, Joe, aren't they? At some stage of their lives. Oh, dear.
From the documentary On One Last Saturday, produced by Ronan Kelly. Well, on Wednesday, Mary Wilson spoke with George Bisos, human rights lawyer and longtime friend of Nelson Mandela. Madiba is known for his sense of humour, and George reminisced about the day Mandela received the Nobel Peace Prize.
He said that, and he said it to the King of Norway on the receipt of the Nobel Prize. After the ceremony, the honoured ones have to go and visit the King and take a couple of people with them. And he introduced me to the King. George Bisos, my lawyer. I don't know why I brought him with me. He sent me to jail for 27 years. I had a response because Mr. de Klerk was there, the co-winner. And I said, Your Majesty, I think that Mr. de Klerk bears higher responsibility than me. I don't think that Mr. de Klerk was pleased with me, but I said it.
And Mary also asked George Bisos if he thought he would ever see Mandela again.
I saw him a week before he was hospitalized, but I'm pleased that there is, as there has been on a number of occasions in the past when he was hospitalized, that the end is not near for him. I want to see him at his home as soon as his half-expected release takes place and talk about the things that we did together and some of the things that we couldn't do together in the past.
From Drive Time on Wednesday. Well, the recession has given many of us a yearning for the way we were, and this certainly was the case on Countrywide last week. Joe McCann is one of a group of grow-it-yourself enthusiasts who've planted up the Countrywide allotment, and he gave some tips to producer Sinead Egan.
Can you talk me through that day when you first would have taken some of your vegetables home, cooked it or threw it in a salad bowl and you had that first taste?
Yeah, the first thing I probably noticed was I had to really wash it. Where you're used to buying stuff in the supermarket, and it sort of brought back a memory of something from the past, because I always remembered washing lettuce and being given the job at home when I was a child to wash lettuce, and I sort of hated it. But that memory sort of coming back was something I really enjoyed, you know, to actually wash it and take the care of it and make sure everything was nice and sort of pat it out and that. And I remembered an old tip my mother gave me to keep lettuce fresh was to put it in water with a piece of coal, which keeps it nice and fresh. There seemed to me to be a flavour of the past. I don't know whether my mind was playing games or not, but it sort of transported me back to an older time.
Well, listen, you have me hungry for a taste of it now, I must say.
Who needs rocket and chard when a no-nonsense lettuce leaf can elicit such a powerful memory? Gardener Joe McCann with Sinead Egan on Countrywide. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for George Lee. He'll be here just after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. But I leave you now with the song from Mary Coughlan, with Eleanor McAvoy on guitar and James Delaney on piano. They played live for Pat Kenny on Monday. Gramagav Asrogoluder, Tasulam Gurwanshev Saltasaglor, Agaskameshev Lam Takanamakiana, and Tachtan Chahogin, Gajishin, Gajishab Slan.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Stay here with me, tell me no lies, just hold me close and don't patch your night. Something that it was.